Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. We are on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can actually listen to this show any time of day or night, thanks to the wonderful work of Santa Fe's own Dotfoil Computer Services. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Ben Luce about New Mexico's solar energy future. Right now, I'd like to welcome Paul Golding. He's the editor of the Santa Fe Boys newsletter. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
It's great to have you.
Thank you.
What's the Santa Fe Boys newsletter?
Well, it's a newsletter that comes out two or three times a year, primarily oriented to the situation of boys in Santa Fe, or to try to bring some attention to the situation of boys in Santa Fe. I've been publishing it now for 4 years. It includes 81 articles over those 4 years, which you can find at www.santafeboys.org. The articles have been all over the subject of boys, general pieces about boys, a lot of statistical data about boys, interview with boys and young men about their experiences, interviews with superintendents, judges, professors of education, teachers.
What's the topic? What's the idea? I mean, we live in a sexist society where girls have and women have generally gotten the short end of the stick in many ways. What's up with boys?
Well, the main focus is to try to bring some attention to the fact that boys' academic performance especially has declined. It's not only that girls have done a lot better in the last 30 years of focusing on their educational achievement, as I think has been absolutely necessary and justified and well worth that, but the boys have actually declined in their academic achievement in terms of the proportion of males that graduate from high school and college.
Now, are we talking New Mexico or nationally?
Both. As in most statistics, usually these things are more pronounced in New Mexico than elsewhere, but all over.
To what do you attribute that decline?
Most generally, I would say that boys don't feel terribly welcome in the culture.
And girls do?
I think more. There's been a lot of studies recently which have shown, for example, in families, how much more educational expectations are higher for girls than for boys. There's been a major shift. It was even in the Santa Fe New Mexican this weekend. There's been a major change, and it's leading to a situation, I fear, where we're going to find a increasing amount of uneducated and unemployable men in this culture, since education is much more important than it ever has been.
Who do you think is exerting this pressure to discriminate against boys?
Discriminate is your word.
Well, they're less welcome in the culture and that their expectations are lower than girls. That's a kind of discrimination.
Well, I think it's a very unconscious process. I don't think it's a political decision per se. I think it's happening fairly broadly and unconsciously.
Unconsciously, but on the part of whom?
On the part of, I think, generally, culture in general, both men and women.
Are you talking about parents, teachers, school, superintendents, principals? Who are you talking about?
All of the above. I think it's a fairly broad-based neglect of boys. Neglect is the word I would use, not discrimination.
So what does it actually look like?
Well, in schools, yeah. What does it look like? I think that I did an article in the last newsletter by a letter from a concerned father, a professor of religion, who talks about his experiences. And he quotes a Newsweek article in which too many girls treat boys as defective girls. Too many schools treat boys as defective girls. And he goes on to give some examples of how TV news stories focus much more on girls than on boys in situations where where actually you would expect to see more attention to boys. I've included in the past list of kinds of advice that might be useful to teachers and about teaching to boys. And maybe if I read one or two of these items, you get a sense what I'm talking about. For example, this is from Peter West, who's from a university in Australia. Advice number one, talk less. Boys are not terribly good listeners. Cut the words you use down to an absolute minimum. Get boys active early in the lesson. Avoid a long preamble. The opposite of that is the way I think education has gone lately, and it's affected boys negatively.
When you say that boys aren't good listeners, isn't the job of a teacher to cultivate good listening skills?
Well, I think the job of a teacher is to take the student that she has and try to teach to that student. And if we see across the culture a tremendous decline, we have
is it tremendous? I mean, yeah. You're using big words here.
Yes. I mean, in New Mexico, we can see a marked decline right now, New Mexican post-secondary educational institutions are approaching 60% female, 40% male. That's a big decline over the last 10 years from approximately equal. I would say that's a big decline, a very large decline. And the interesting thing is the tendency, the trend, is toward an increase, not doing anything about it.
I was reading some of your newsletters, and one of them said, there was a quotation from a teacher saying, I would love to have an all-boys class where we could improve their reading skills through having them read and write about things like football and sports. And I thought, I don't know, I had this reaction to it, like, if you start separating genders and giving each gender the thing that they are just inherently most interested in and leaving out all the other stuff, how do you keep from creating a culture of grown-ups where the two genders don't understand each other at all?
Well, I'm afraid that's where we're headed when we have a large number of men who are uneducated and unemployable. Certainly the situation we're in now is not good.
But the point is, when I slogged through junior high and high school, virtually every book we read was by a man. I had to read The Lord of the Flies. We read Shakespeare. We read The Red Badge of Courage. We read the hero books. We read The Iliad and The Odyssey. There was not a feminine moment in any of them except maybe Jane Austen. And, you know, it was hard at the time. I didn't want to read those books. I hated them. I was bored by them. But we had to read them. We had to, you know, take the test, have the discussion. And guess what? As an adult, I understand more through having been that. Why wouldn't you put both boys and girls through that?
I think the objective of reading in schools is to teach boys to read. A good book for a boy is one he will read. A lot of the books today assigned in schools are books that boys don't want to read.
Like what?
I have to refer to an article I did recently about some single-sex classes in Jane Austen, for example, would be a good one. And I'm sorry, that's the only one that comes to mind.
Well, I'll give you Jane Austen, but then do you think girls who hate reading some of these war books should not have to read those either?
Actually, in Pauake, that's what they're not making girls read those books. They're reading other kinds of things. They're reading things that girls want to read as well. So at some point in a career, in an educational career, yes, but I'm talking mostly about elementary school and middle school, where I think really all you really want to do is encourage reading primarily. And if you can't get a boy engaged in reading, and he leaves elementary school turned off by the subject, which many boys are doing, you've got a problem. You've got a problem that's probably not going to be resolved by the end of his educational career.
We also have girls who are reading at very low levels in the Santa Fe public schools. We've got third graders who can barely read. We've got seventh graders reading at the third grade level. It seems to me there's also a big problem in the school system whose root I do not know. of kids not learning to read properly.
Well, reading isn't as bad as math, and in that, all the students are doing very poorly. But in reading, actually, the test scores are a lot better for boys, for girls, rather. They're much, much better. And I'm sure there are examples of individual girls who need help, and I'm sure that they're trying to deal with that in the school system. But I'm talking about the general tendency. When you look at the total school system in Santa Fe and New Mexico, and even in Los Alamos, you will always see that boys are doing much worse in reading and writing than girls.
We're talking to Paul Golding, editor of the Santa Fe Boys Newsletter. Now, an author and doctor named Leonard Sachs is going to be in town on Monday giving an in-service training to Santa Fe public and middle school teachers at the Santa Maria de la Paz Church pretty much all day from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, and other people are welcome as well. And then he's giving a lecture at the Santa Fe Community College at 7 o'clock at night. Tell us about Dr. Sachs. He's the author of this book, Why Gender Matters. What is he doing here? What's he bringing to Santa Fe?
Well, let me first say he's a family physician. He has a private practice in suburban Washington, D.C. He's also a Ph.D. psychologist, and he's written two books. One is called Why Gender Matters, What Parents and Teachers Need to Know About the Emerging Science of Sex Differences. The other book, which is about to be published, is called Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men. I should also mention that he's the founder and executive director of the National Association of Single-Sex Public Education, which is based outside of Washington. Some people may think that because Dr. Sachs is being sponsored by Santa Fe Boys, he's primarily a boy expert or going to talk about boys, and he will in the evening lecture. But right now he's in Australia, and he's been invited to Australia by the Australian Federation of Girls' Schools. He's going around the continent lecturing different faculties and staff of girls' schools about how girls learn.
So he believes in segregated education for girls and boys.
So Dr. Sachs has a lot to say of interest to both boys and girls. He doesn't believe in segregated education. Excuse me. He thinks that because of the different ways that boys and girls learn, it is a good alternative to provide to students, like they're doing in Pauake, for example. They have five fifth-grade classes, and one is for girls, one is for boys, and three are for mix. And a parent can choose where the parent would like the child to go. So that's the kind of situation that he supports, and that is consistent with federal law.
How's that working out?
In Pauaka, they've had very good test results on the MAPS test, the measures of academic progress, which they give at the beginning of the year and in the middle of the year and at the end of the year. They've noticed that in reading and writing, boys' scores have increased tremendously. Girls' scores in math have gone up. So the tentative news on Pauake is that it's quite a successful experiment. They're doing something similar at a middle school in Albuquerque, at Van Buren Middle School. And similarly there, they've noticed a big improvement in mostly in behavioral issues.
So he will be, what will be the nature of the training on Monday?
Well, the training, as you talk about, the workshop, will consist in three parts. And the first part, I think, will be most of the morning on Monday, will be of interest to a lot of people. And there he'll talk about innate gender differences. And as he says, the more you know about these differences, the better you will be able to broaden your students' educational horizons. And I think that goes for all people who work with children. The more they know about the neurological and physiological differences and how these affect the interactions of children, particularly with education, but in other situations, will be very helpful. So this is not only limited or not only targeted to Santa Fe public school teachers in the middle school level, but it will also be for, it's also being offered to social service providers in the community. And I would say parents with an interest in this subject would also be welcome.
As for me personally, as somebody who for 12 years of schooling was always better than at math than in reading, I find myself wondering about this. I did a lot of reading last night about Sachs and about the whole question of gender differences, and it is pretty well established that the differences in learning style within a group of girls or within a group of boys is much greater than differences between them. So when you talk about the differences between girls and boys, you're working with averages. First of all, if the data is even correct, but second, you're working with averages, and in fact, a lot of people are not going to live up to those stereotypes. How do you deal with the great danger inherent in this and stereotyping your own students?
Well, I think Dr. Sachs will address that very clearly. Excuse me again. He describes the great variation you will find among students, and he'll describe strategies for dealing with students who do not fall into the typical pattern. But I think a lot of the differences between men and women, between boys and girls, are things that probably can't be measured really well. They're a little bit more elusive than that. And I think most of us agree that there are pretty significant differences. And we don't quite have a very good articulated handle on the differences. I think that an effort like Dr. Sachs's to bring the issue to bear, to describe the research in it, is a very valuable one, and one which I think anyone who hears it will find very fascinating.
Yeah, it's just still, I mean, again, you know, one of the things that Sachs brings up in his work is that there's a great difference in the ability for emotional expression. So somehow the part of the brain in girls that can express emotions versus boys is very different. And I think, well, you know, I was reading Neruda's autobiography, and Neruda, as a teenager, one of the most expressive poets of all time, and then becomes very famous, and all of these young men come up to him reading Neruda's poetry aloud. You know, you have Chile, a culture where boys, girls, men, women know poetry by heart as young people. And then you say that boys are you know, it just doesn't makes sense.
You know, maybe he went to an all-boys school. One of the things Sachs points out is...
I don't think so.
Do you know?
I'm not sure. I have to go back to the work. But the point
is,
everybody
things,
was...
One of the things that Sachs points out is that many of the great artists of the past who have been men all went to boys' schools, went through single-sex education. One of the interesting things about single-sex education is how it does create a kind of counterintuitive gender balance with whoever goes through it. I mean, boys tend to be more, there's more diversity to the way a boy can be, and there's more diversity to the way girls are in when they're separated by sex, especially if it's handled well, which Sex describes a lot. By the way, he's not going to be talking about separate sex education unless he's asked about it here in Santa Fe, because he knows that Santa Fe isn't particularly interested in this subject right now. But he may be asked about it. It may come up. I just mentioned that as a possibility for a lot of men of the past did go to single-sex schools, and perhaps that affected their abilities to do what they're doing.
Well, all this and much, much more can be found by getting in touch with Paul Golding. The website is santafeboys.org. And is there a phone number that people can call if they're interested in meeting Dr. Sachs and doing this work on Monday?
Sure. They could call the Santa Fe Boys number 988-9582.
And go to santafeboys.org. And how can people get your newsletter?
They can go to santafeboys.org and get the contact information there.
Paul Golding is editor of the Santa Fe Boys newsletter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking about solar energy. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Ben Luce. He is the director of the New Mexico Coalition for Clean and Affordable Energy. He is a theoretical physicist at Los Alamos National Labs, and he's speaking today at 6 o'clock with the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. That's from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Street, about the subject of solar energy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here, Mary.
It's great to have you. The impetus for looking at renewable energy, solar energy in particular right now, is the extremely tight time frame that we have in terms of the necessity of slowing down climate change to a non-catastrophic rate. What's the best thinking that you know about the necessary reduction in greenhouse gases over the next, say, 10 to 30 years?
Well, people are saying that we need to keep the carbon levels below 450 parts per million if we want to avoid crossing certain thresholds that would do things like really trigger melting of the Greenland ice sheet, acidification of the oceans, other things like that. And some people even talk about sudden catastrophic climate change that might occur at some point after that. We really don't understand the geodynamics enough to really know for sure that something really catastrophic might happen. So people are saying that's necessary. And in order to reach those reductions, we need to basically get those reductions underway in the next 10 years.
Get them underway or have them done?
Well, to go to zero carbon emissions is going to be very, very difficult. That's going to take probably many decades, at least 5, maybe 10 decades to really go all that way. But what they're talking about is putting us on a steep downward decline in emissions within 10 years, and such that by, say, 2050, we can reach an 80% reduction in emissions.
Those are not the numbers that come from government a lot. They talk about, you know, slowing down the rate of growth of greenhouse gas emissions, or, you know, going down 10% by the year 3000 or whatever. You know, you're talking very steep numbers.
That's true, although people that are saying this are government scientists, people like James Hansen. He's been in the news a lot, as people know, because the Bush administration actually really actively tried to suppress his statements. They had somebody literally following him around and trying to edit and whatnot. That was exposed, however, and I think the stuff has come out more into the open now.
So oil, gas, and coal currently provide the vast majority of the world's energy. And to contextualize the need for solar energy, which we're going to get to, I think it's really instructive to look at the work of Daniel Nocera from MIT. He breaks down the world's energy needs over the next 45 years, and he shows the real potential of nuclear, biomass, hydroelectric. They're not as great as people think.
That's correct. It would take, even if we used all the wind power, all the biomass resources, those are the kind of renewables that we're currently deploying at large scale. We'd still need 10, you know, upwards of, just to meet the additional load, 8,000 new nuclear power plants. If we were really going to replace the whole fossil fuel infrastructure, we're looking at something like 20 to 30,000 nuclear power plants if we don't get moving fast on solar energy. And I think that presents a very serious threat to security. Nuclear power plants make plutonium. The spent fuel rods contain plutonium. I think we'd be in really difficult shape trying to control the spread of weapons, for example, if we were to increase the number of nuclear power plants by a factor of 100 over what we have now.
Not to mention you'd have to build a new one every other day. You'd have to come up with all the fuel to fuel them. And if there's ever an accident, nobody's going to want to use them.
That's right. You bet. A lot of problems there.
Let's talk about the potential of solar power, which seems to be the great hope among renewable energy sources. What is the reality and the potential, as you see it, of solar power plants at this time in producing energy at levels comparable to existing coal and nuclear plants?
Well, if you just do a straightforward calculation, you take into account the conversion efficiency of solar power plants, look at the intensity of sunlight. With a small area in the southwest, about 59 miles by about 59 miles, we could provide, for example, all the electricity for the United States. And that's really a very tiny piece of land. I think we probably use more land to grow arugula and a few things like that than it would take to provide all that energy.
Now, all the electricity, but not all the energy that goes into heating and transportation.
Well, let's say, yeah, fair enough. That's true. However, we are moving towards electric transportation and other forms of energy use that are more efficient. So electricity is about a third. If we if we could probably...
It's a third of total energy use?
It's about a third, yeah. So we could probably get up to about 50% of current energy use as being electricity and lose the other 50% through efficiency and getting rid of all the lost energy that is lost in coal-fired power plants and things like that. So we probably, to really do all the energy in the United States, you're probably talking about a 100-mile by 100-mile area. And again, that's fairly small potatoes compared to agriculture, the area just that we use for roads and things like that. So there really isn't an energy resource problem. It's really more of just a matter of accessing that resource.
Well, what are the economics so far? You have high capital costs when you build any new plant, solar or otherwise, which makes the initial cost of energy higher. Under what circumstances does solar energy become competitive?
Right. Well, solar is just emerging, and it hasn't reached the kind of economies of scale that you can get with the fossil fuel industry. What's amazing is that that we are as close as we are, that these technologies are even within spitting distance of being cost effective. And the predictions are that solar energy, which is about, for say home solar, is about, for solar electricity, I should say, is about maybe two or three times as expensive as retail rates. That's predicted to be competitive in about 10 years. And solar hot water, and passive solar, some of these other very straightforward things are already cost effective, and we should be doing them in spades now just simply for economic reasons. And we're even having trouble getting that happening fast enough. So.
And we'll get to that in a second, but I was wondering, I was at your lecture last night, the Santa Fe Institute lecture, where you were talking about all these things, and there are some examples of actually existing electric power plants that are solar-powered, solar power plants. The technology is evolving so rapidly, and I wondered if there were disincentives to building a plant right now. In other words, it might become outdated by the time it's competitive.
That's true to some extent. I'm sure that causes some people some pause about investing money right away when they think it might be cheaper in a few years. However, the large-scale solar power plants, such as the SEGS plants out in California, those have been operating for nearly 20 years, and they're still going. They're expected to go for another 50 years. So I think this is just part of the overall cost to society, is we have to pay a little more initially for those initial plants. But many of those plants will remain in service for many decades and provide a lot of clean power. And the cost projections are that the cost comes down very, very quickly as society really starts to invest in this. And we're seeing that. The costs of solar are decreasing exponentially fast now and are on track. The reason there's so much excitement now is because it is becoming quite affordable, and a lot of people are doing it, and a lot of cities and states are doing it. So the future looks pretty bright for solar right now.
Does a solar plant have a life cycle the way a nuclear plant has, say, a 30, 40-year life cycle, then you got to shut it down?
Well, it's interesting because many of the basic components of these solar plants, in principle, could last almost indefinitely. They don't really degrade very much. The curved mirrors that reflect the light, the backing for those, if those are built right, the SEGS plants in California are estimated to have at least another 50 years left in them. And it's interesting because we may be looking at solar technologies coming out that will eventually last much longer than a human's lifespan, and that has interesting implications for the cost of energy. If you actually amortize over those kind of life scales, solar potentially looks dirt cheap.
We're talking to Ben Luce, and he will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. The topic is New Mexico's Solar Energy Future. It's from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Street. Now, the energy efficiency of solar panels, as you discussed in your talk last night, is about 20%. That is, 20% of the energy that comes from the sun is made into electricity. So the 1,000 watts that fall on the one square meter becomes 200 watts of electricity. What are those efficiency numbers for solar power plants?
For the large-scale solar power plants that are up and running today, it's a little bit lower. Those concentrating solar power plants is about 15%. However, there's a lot of indications that that can probably be increased the same way it has increased pretty steadily for photovoltaics. I'm guessing those big plants will start coming in around 20% as they get optimized. The solar PV panels that you put on your roof, some of those now in the laboratory are up in the 30s, and there's theoretical breakthroughs that have occurred which could push those into the up to 60-70% in coming decades. So those look very good from an efficiency standpoint. And you can buy that the 20% photovoltaic panel today.
You show, and we'll get to that in a second, because I think a lot of people would like to do something, but they don't even know where to begin, and I think this is something where we can be helpful. But you showed some graphs comparing energy use in the summer and winter. How does the need for electricity, for example, in New Mexico, vary between summer and winter?
Well, cities like Albuquerque and Santa Fe have a pretty big air conditioning load in the summer, so their peak does tend to go way up. It's interesting, in Santa Fe, there's a little bit of a winter peak, too. Apparently, a lot of people are heating with electricity in the wintertime in the evening, and that's a little bit disturbing. But that peak is still much lower than what you see typically in the summertime. So this is a good thing for solar, because you get longer days in the summer, and your big solar power plants can produce a lot more.
But presumably the overall need for energy is higher in the winter in cold climates.
For heating and things like that. However, a lot of that heating load can be reduced just through much better efficiency. We are not even close to having buildings that are as efficient as they could be in terms of just retaining the heat. A well-designed passive solar house in New Mexico can easily cut 80% of the heating load out, and if you want to go farther than that, you can by just taking a few extra measures.
What are the comparative advantages of, say, putting 100,000 solar panels on 100,000 rooftops on people's houses versus taking that same amount of technology and making a centralized solar power plant?
I think we're going to need a lot of both. This has to do with the time scales. There are certain niches that both centralized and distributed have. Distributed is great because you don't have to build new transmission for it, and so it can go right on the roof and displace load. However, there are some definite economies of scale to building the centralized plants, and there's a lot of promise for deploying those very quickly and cutting coal emissions very dramatically, probably about 10 times faster than we can do with distributed, just based on where the markets are going at the moment.
So building, in terms of dealing with the reality at hand, namely the coal-powered plants that we have, building a new solar plant is a lot faster than, say, subsidizing people to put panels on their roofs?
Well, again, I think we need to do both, because if you allow the load to grow, especially the peak load to grow in the cities, then you're going to require more transmission. So distributed is a great way to start cutting into that load growth right away, and that has real economic benefits. So I think we need strong subsidies in both, and roughly of equal dollars. But what will happen is the dollars put into the centralized will go a little further in terms of energy, at least in the short term, because of the economies of scale of those plants. I think as distributed also is growing exponentially, eventually it may be in the 2020 sort of frame, it will really come to the fore as a major source as well. I think the vision is to replace all that centralized coal and nuclear with centralized solar, and then meet all the additional load growth, and then the long-term load growth with distributed. Also, distributed has some advantages for society, I think, from some social political advantages, putting more power back in the communities. And that kind of will help, I think, keep those big utilities in check a little bit from doing the wrong thing, because they know that if they really piss people off, people are really going to move towards distributed, and that's a more equitable situation.
Let's talk about the relative efficiencies of heating water directly and converting it to electricity. So if you've got a solar panel, you can heat water that heats your house through radiant floor heat or whatever kind of heat, or you can make electricity. In terms of just pure data, efficiency data, what is the better use of the sun?
Well, we all like to take showers and have warm houses, and that's a very efficient way to use solar energy, just to collect the heat and use it for heating purposes. And that's probably the most cost-effective form of solar today, especially if you're talking about active solar systems, putting panels on your roof. But the other route, as you're mentioning, is you go use different equipment and you generate heat at much higher temperatures, and you can use that to generate generate steam and generate electricity. And that's also looks like a very good technology, and is what people are starting to deploy now in, on large scale. Basically, a coal-fired power plant is just a big machine that boils water and runs a big locomotive, the stationary locomotive, essentially. And that's what we're looking at, is just is basically swapping
finding
out.
A different way to boil water.
Finding a different way to boil water. That's all it is.
Now, how would a solar plant, I mean, if you've got a coal plant or nuclear plant or whatever, it's working 24/7. A solar plant only works when the sun shines. How do you provide electricity at night?
That's a really good question. You know, people are always saying, well, you can't do solar because the sun doesn't shine all the time. Well, it's very cost effective to store that solar thermal energy at large centralized plants underground or in things, materials such as molten salt. You can build a plant that stores energy and runs into the evening or runs all night long or even runs a couple of days without any sun. That's really not a problem. And on the distributed side, we're seeing storage technologies emerge. Great advances are happening in batteries and other storage mechanisms, which look very promising for things like plug-in hybrids and just new long-lasting batteries that you could have an off-grid solar house, for example.
So, what are the storage methods that you're actually talking about for solar power plants?
One of them is called molten salt storage, and basically they just have giant vats of this molten salt, which has a high heat capacity, and they actually run that salt when it's cooler right through the solar collector. So it heats up, and they store that heat in a tank. It takes about 3 cubic feet per house of that kind of storage to store enough energy to power a house, and that's actually not very much space.
Now, does that work less well in the winter?
No, it works just fine in the winter. You have less sunshine. You have less hours of the day. So you've got to make sure that your system is, you have enough solar collectors out there to meet the demand. But that's pretty straightforward to engineer. And fortunately, the electricity load is quite a bit lower in the wintertime. So that's quite feasible.
Are you also talking about using the molten salt technology in these solar generating plants?
Yeah, the molten salt technology is being used in the power tower type plants. These are a particular kind of centralized large-scale solar generation. But another company in Australia has unearthed some old DOE data showing that for other types of systems, it's very economical just to store compressed hot water underground, essentially make a man-made geothermal well. And that looks like it's a fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour cost. It's very, very affordable. And when you start to think about it, it makes sense. Storing a large volume of hot water, as that volume gets bigger and bigger, its surface area gets smaller and smaller, so it doesn't radiate heat very effectively. You can store that heat very economically for a very long time. And water just has a fantastic heat capacity. It's the best energy battery around.
But again, even in the winter when it's 0 degrees outside, that storage isn't compromised?
No, because the temperature changes we feel from winter to summer, we experience them as pretty dramatic changes. But that's because we're basically high surface area water-based beings that evolved in a more tropical environment. Those temperature changes compared to the temperature changes that you see in the solar plant, in the collector, and the storage system are trivial. They won't sense that climate change hardly at all.
Now, you've alluded a little bit to the energy that could be used, solar energy that could be used for heating and transportation for cars. Basically, what, making hybrid cars run more on electricity than on fossil fuels?
That's right. We've seen the emergence of hybrids now, which is a step towards electric transportation, but the energy is still coming from the gasoline. So people are really aggressively pursuing this idea now of adding extra batteries to these hybrids to make what's called a plug-in hybrid. Even today, if you charge that plug-in hybrid off of the wall socket, it's much cheaper than gasoline. And even at today's cost of photovoltaics, it's actually competitive to charge plug-in hybrids off of solar. So it's very attractive, and tremendous progress has been made in batteries. There's a couple of competing battery technologies out there, and several of them look like they're going to be viable.
It doesn't weigh down the car so much that it reduces the mileage?
No, not too much. It's, you re-engineer the car, but there's a lot that can be done in just building a lighter frame, for example, to offset that a little bit. And the batteries, the newer batteries, lithium-ion batteries, are pretty good. The key thing, though, is that the electric vehicle drive is so much more efficient than an internal combustion engine that that's a factor of 5 difference in efficiency. So you need 5 times as less energy on just that fact. Just taking that factor into account. Now, you still have to compensate for the fact that batteries have a lower, much lower energy density than gasoline, for example. But things still work out pretty well, and we're actually seeing companies like Tesla and whatnot try to commercialize actual practical vehicles.
We're talking to Ben Luce. We have now to really go into the whole political question. A rapid conversion to solar would require a massive amount of political will, and I wondered how you see that development given the realities of and the tenacity of big oil and big coal.
Yeah, this is the key question. It's not really a technological or economic question, in my view. Those companies like to say it is. They like to say, well, we need big breakthroughs in solar or something to move forward. That's just an excuse, I think, not to do anything. We have seen a tremendous change in consciousness around climate change. I think our governor, our state legislature, has been quite supportive of taking some pretty good steps in the right direction. But it's still an open question whether we're going to make it in time, and it's going to be very close. It's going to be one of those hairbreadth escapes if we escape the worst ravages of climate change. And we need to work very hard to make sure that those corporations that are likely going to be somewhat losers in this don't succeed in slowing the process down too much.
Are they getting involved in the process? It's hard to imagine a company like ExxonMobil converting to being some kind of solar energy green company.
Well, I think they speak it with forked tongue, basically. You see underneath the surface they're actually putting a fair amount of money into investigating what they might have to do to accommodate, either move into new types of energy sources or try to sequester their carbon underground. At the same time, Exxon is well known to be funding the global warming denier crowd, those corporate scientists who sow confusion and whatnot about climate change. So it's a mixed bag. They're not stupid on the level of trying to survive economically, so they're looking at all their options. But on the other hand, I think they really have slowed down the transition by at least maybe 15 years.
And 15 years is not something we have leeway to play with.
No, we're out of time. The transition has to start in a major way, basically now. And in many places it is. Many states in the United States now have passed strong renewable energy standards. Europe has very strong renewable energy incentives. Japan has very strong incentives. Even China is now installing millions of solar systems, for example, and planting just incredible numbers of trees and other things like that. So I think the world is starting to wake up. It's now basically a horse race. The saving grace, though, is that new technologies can grow exponentially fast. And that's people's intuition is geared more to linear thinking, to extrapolating linear. That's not what's happening with the solar industry. It's growing at 31% a year. And if we can keep that growth rate up, that's enough probably to fix the problem in the next 2 decades. It's really profound how technology can do that.
Well, if there is a cap on carbon dioxide emissions.
Right. Well, this is another point, is that it's not sufficient just to get renewables. We're going to need to cap carbon. The reason is because the world is also looking at things like oil shale and tar sands as new sources of oil, for example. It takes a lot of energy to convert those resources into oil. And now people should understand there's a tremendous amount of fossil fuels out there if you're willing to pay for it. And running out of oil doesn't get us out of the climate change problem at all. In fact, it makes it worse. It potentially cripples the economics enough to force society to look at oil shales and actually increase demand. And we could be looking at literally wind power and solar powered oil shale wells in the future.
Which doesn't get you anywhere, basically.
Which doesn't get us anywhere. So we need to look at the root of the problem. We need to cap carbon, put a price on it, and then complement that with all kinds of other things, incentives for renewables and efficiency. And I think the best solutions are renewables fuels and efficiency. A lot of people are proposing nuclear power and carbon sequestered coal and things like that. I personally don't feel those are the best solutions for a wide number of reasons. But it's going to be a very complex process to see which solutions are actually deployed at any significant scale.
So New Mexico has policies, including new legislation from the last session, promoting renewable energy. What do you think are the most important of those policies that New Mexico has?
Well, the key policy is the renewable energy standard that requires the utilities to provide a certain fraction of their power from renewables. In this case, 10% by 2011, 15% by 2015, 20% by 2020.
Numbers are much lower than what you're saying the need is.
Well, they may sound low, but what people have to realize is that's a significant percentage of a very large fossil fuel infrastructure that costs many billions of dollars. So the renewable energy standard as it stands now is already worth $1 billion, and half a billion has already been spent. What the purpose of the RPS is not so much to do the whole job, but it's to get this stuff deployed at the economies of scale that it needs to compete. The utilities then potentially can do quite a bit more, and we can look at other policies. So, for example, this year the legislature also introduced production tax credits for the large-scale solar, green building tax credits, stronger efficiency programs, a whole range of other things to get at this. And remember that the thing is we need to get things on a steep downward decline. It doesn't mean we have to go to 100% in 10 years. That probably wouldn't be an economically viable solution. We'd have rate revolts and things like that, I think, if we tried to push it that far. However, we can go to 10%, 20%, maybe 30% in the next decade or two, and hopefully at that point the renewables will be competitive. The entire consciousness of both the public and the industry will change, and the power of distributed generation coming in will also change the politics. And I think at that point we'll be able to transition fairly rapidly.
There are people who are listening to the show who have probably thought many times, should I put a solar panel on my roof? How do non-experts make decisions like that? I mean, you can always find somebody who wants to sell you something, but how do you make intelligent choices?
There's a lot of difficulty in approaching this, and part of it is that there's a bunch of different incentives out there. People need to get familiar with the costs, find installers, all of that stuff. We have a How to Go Solar guide on our website, which is a good start. That'll lead people through that. But in general, what we suggest to people is look at energy efficiency first. See what you can do with your changing out your appliances to Energy Star level appliances. Get rid of all those incandescent light bulbs. By the way, we need recycling programs for compact fluorescents. We have more work to do on that, but compact fluorescents are still a good idea.
But I mean, for example, in my house and probably in most people's houses, electricity accounts for a small part of the overall energy that I use.
It may seem like that, but from an emission standpoint, that's not true because the coal plant is very inefficient. It's producing that. So it's producing for every BTU of thermal energy you use from natural gas, if you use that same amount of energy and electricity, you're actually creating three times as much emissions. So they roughly balance out. That we need to get at both sectors in a very aggressive way. And coal-fired electricity generation, in fact, is commonly identified as the biggest problem. It's the fastest growing and largest contributor to CO2 emissions. But efficiency is a great way to go first and weatherize the house, the windows. And then when you get done with that, take a look at what you might do with solar energy, adding solar systems or improving the passive solar performance of your house, or maybe buying a Prius or some kind of hybrid vehicle to cut your gasoline emissions. All of these measures not only help decrease the energy usage and the emissions that you incur, but they also actually help drive the market for these things. A final thing people can do is sign up for Green Power. PNM's Sky Blue program is a good program. It's a well-regulated, well-priced program. It really does promote wind power. They can't count it towards the renewable energy standard. And going to things like Green Energy New Mexico, where you can buy green tags.
What is your website? Unfortunately, it's time to go.
Okay, last two things. The website is www.nmccae.org. It's New Mexico Coalition for Clean Affordable Energy. And Green Energy New Mexico, where you can buy green tags, is www.greenenergynm.org.
Ben Luce, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary. It's a pleasure.
And Ben Luce is the director of the New Mexico... where did my piece of paper go? What are you the director of?
The New Mexico Coalition for Clean, Affordable Energy.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can also find us podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan pays tribute to the late clarinetist Alvin Batiste. By the way, the KSFR event with Jeremy Scahill for tonight, unfortunately, has been canceled. His whole tour has been canceled, so don't go over there tonight.